好，
我们下面就开始啊，我们有那。
All right, now we would like to kick off now, and the moderator is Mr. Benjamin Rechenbach.
Our second session. It was a pleasure to continue the discussion during the coffee break, and we will now have a closer look on the implications of geopolitical fragmentation to the financial stability. I think we already touched a lot on this topic, and we will continue this discussion. And I'd like to give the word first to Stephen Barnett, who's the senior resident representative of the IMF in Beijing, and we are very happy that he's here with us to deepen the discussion about the global outlook now after the election of President Trump. And I think we will talk again a lot about trade policy, the question how that will develop, and what will be possible repercussions of policies like tariffs. So, Stephen, the floor is yours.
The PowerPoint made it.
Okay.
Yeah. What's your color? Oh, thanks. Good. That's why I don't wear a coat.
All right.
A big thank you to SDRF and FES for inviting me. I think I've been in Beijing this time 5 years. I think I've come every year but once. So it's really good to be back here. And I'm going to cheat. I'm only covering half the topic. I'll do the globe and then fragmentation. I'm going to punt on financial stability implications, and I'm going to focus a lot on trade implications. So I have a really simple four-word takeaway, and this actually took this from the head of the IMF, Kristalina Georgieva, is that we can do better. So in Chinese, woman nang zou de gong hao. We can do better, and I don't think she meant by we the IMF. I don't think so anyways. I think she meant we, the international community, can do better. And why? Really a pretty simple message. If we look at global outlook and developments, global growth is stable, but it's underwhelming. And you'd like to think as the global community, we can do better than underwhelming. And then I'm going to talk about how to do better. And I'm actually going to flip this and focus a lot on the second point, is that we need a revival of international cooperation. And I'm going to focus a lot on trade. And I'll probably fly through quickly some of the domestic policies countries have to do. I'm not used to standing behind a podium. Usually I'm kind of wandering around, so I'll try to stay put. So why can we do better? If we look at global growth, this slide just shows you global growth. Last year was 3.3%. This year we forecast 3.2. Next year we forecast 3.2. Pretty much definition of stable. So we have a global economy humming along at around 3.25%. This is underwhelming. Global growth in the 4 decades before the pandemic averaged 3.4%. Global growth in the 2 decades before the pandemic averaged 3.8%. Clearly, we can do better than 3.2%. You know, moreover, the global pandemic in 2020 was the largest shock that hit the global economy since the Great Depression. And here I've just marked to show you 2020 compared to the global financial crisis was orders of magnitude worse. So rather than in some ways catching up, the global economy is falling further behind. A brief digression on how the IMF does global forecasts. And we use purchasing power parity weights. It tries to adjust for the fact that goods are generally cheaper in China. So by IMF math, PPP weights, this is a chart on the left. China is the world's largest economy. It has an 18.7% weight last year. If you prefer the more conventional market exchange rates, that's the dollar signs. You can see that the U.S. is still the world's largest and the European Union is a bit bigger than China. The chart on the right just wants to make a point. We've seen a huge shift in the global economy in the last 40 years. Basically, the IMF divides the world into two buckets, advanced economies and emerging and developing economies. 1980, advanced economies were over 60% of the world, and emerging market and developing economies less than 40%. Today, that's flipped. Emerging market and developing economies are about 60% of the world output, and advanced economies about 40%. Much of this is the rise of China, but not all of it. So, what's driving growth in 2024? This just looks at the contributions to global growth in terms of percent. And China has been the single largest contributor to global growth. This year, we expect China to contribute 28% of global growth. This is the chart on the left. The chart on the right decomposes our forecast for global growth through the medium term. And you see the yellow is China and India. China and India together are accounting for nearly 50% of global growth. Remember, we use PPP weights. Under PPP weights, both China and India are large. If I go back a slide, you can see that India is the fourth largest economy and China is the first largest. And both China and India grow fast. I'm not going to dwell on this too much, but I think as an employee of an international organization, I do want to harp on this point that among the scarring in the pandemic, low-income countries have been hit particularly hard, and we shouldn't forget this. So this chart on the left shows our estimates of scarring. How do we define scarring? We say, where did we think the global economy was going to be in 2024? What was the level of GDP going to be based on our forecasts in 2019? And where is it today? So the difference in the level of income that we forecast in 2019 versus what we actually have today, we call that scarring from the pandemic, the war in Ukraine, all of the shocks we've seen. And it turns out the economy as a whole, which is the world line here, has lost about 3.5% of income. That means this year we expect the level of world GDP to be about 3.5% lower. Now there's an outlier here. There's actually two outliers. U.S. actually is running hotter than our pre-pandemic forecasts. I'm an American, and if you looked at the election and the discussion about the economy, hard to believe that the U.S. has arguably been the best performing economy during the pandemic, certainly measured by this metric of scarring. It's running above pre-pandemic forecasts. Advanced economies as a whole are basically at our pre-pandemic forecasts, so very little scarring. So the scarring is all coming from EMDE. That stands for Emerging Market and Developing Economies. In the very bottom bar, low-income countries, low-income developing countries, LIDC, have around 9% lost output from the pandemic. Those countries least able to afford it have been hit the hardest. That's growth. The chart on the right says they've also been hit the hardest by inflation. Horizontal axis is income per capita. Vertical axis is increase in the price level. So these economies not only have suffered the biggest losses in output, they've also seen in general the highest increases in prices. So when we can do better, I probably won't dwell on this, one of the areas we, the global community, can do better is providing support to these low-income and vulnerable economies. If the near-term outlook isn't underwhelming enough, the medium-term outlook is also underwhelming. So here, the chart on the left shows you what we forecast for growth in October 2019. Our medium-term forecast, an IMF medium-term is 5 years. We forecast five-year ahead growth to be 3.6%. Now our forecast for five-year ahead growth is 3.1. The chart on the right, a little bit confusing, and it's actually from April, it doesn't include the latest point, shows you our five-year ahead forecast at all times. So if you look at 2019, you see it's at 3.6. Lowest medium-term forecast we've had since the 90s, and I think that's only because the data stops then. If we go back further, I think it's the lowest we've ever had. Clearly, we can do better than this. We have a global economy that current growth is below average. level of activity is below pre-pandemic levels, and instead of catching up, we're falling further behind, and we have the lowest medium-term forecast. So when the head of the IMF says we can do better, I think she has a good point. I'll come back to this at the end, but you know, we do point forecasts, and the chart on the right just reminds people that there's a distribution around those forecasts. And the chart on the left, which I'll come back to a more complicated version, shows you different risks and how those risks could affect the growth path. And relevant for our discussion would be the second line, tariff and trade policy uncertainty. Clearly, it's not good for growth. And again, I'll come back to this towards the end, but that this chart is showing the reduction from our baseline in GDP due to different kinds of shocks. It's not all bad news. Looks like for the first time ever, we're going to have a global soft landing, meaning that inflation is coming down without a recession. So definitely some good news. I'm not going to explain all the charts. I'd be here for an hour if I explained every chart. So some of these I'm just going to fly through. So we talked about, we've been focusing on three domestic policy pivots. And apologies, I'm going to go through these quickly because I want to get to the fragmentation bit. But I think it's important. The domestic policies, pivot one is to finish the fight against inflation. The good news is global inflation is coming down. The shaded part is our forecasts, and we forecast, and this is period average, global inflation to return to normal quite soon. The chart on the left shows you the distribution of inflation relative to central bank targets. And just to show you, across countries, we expect inflation to be returning back to central bank targets. So pivot one is to finish the fight against inflation and normalize monetary policy. The chart on the right just shows you our assumptions for the path of global interest rates that underpin our forecasts. Pivot two is fiscal. We know that countries built up a lot of debt during the pandemic, government debt, and basically it's time to rebuild buffers. So the chart on the left just shows you the rise in debt and the distribution around our forecasts, but a key message we have is rebuild buffers. Best ways to do this, have a medium-term credible fiscal adjustment plan, try to do it in a way as growth friendly as possible, and try not to do it on the backs of the poor and vulnerable. Maybe a little bit cookie cutter advice, but these are the general principles we have for our countries as they adjust. We shouldn't sugarcoat it though. Fiscal adjustment is rarely good for growth. So it's going to be a headwind. The chart on the right just shows you a key challenge is that interest payments as a share of fiscal revenue have gone way up. And I want to harp on the right line, the red line, coming again back to this point about divergence. Low-income developing countries, interest payments now take about 15% of revenue, triple the level from 2008. So 15% of every dollar they raise immediately goes to pay interest on the debt. So that's the second pivot. The third pivot, and one that I think is actually the most important and maybe underappreciated, is to boost medium-term growth. The real way to boost medium-term growth, and I'll be a geeky macroeconomist here for a minute, is to boost productivity. You know, so us macro people like to think that growth comes from three factors. You can add labor, you can add capital, or you can use your labor and capital better. Ultimately, the red bars, the red part of those bars shows you the contribution to global growth from productivity, this use it better component. It's been falling. And so a key challenge is to find reforms to boost productivity. And now I'm going to come in the last few minutes to the fragmentation. So we looked at different scenarios and how much they can contribute to boosting growth in the medium term. And again, remember, we have our lowest forecast for medium term growth. I'm not going to walk through all of them, but I do want to highlight structural reforms. The biggest one is structural reforms here to reduce the misallocation. Just to highlight that often when we think of growth, we tend to think of innovation, that innovation drives productivity. True, but it's also true that better allocation of resources also drives growth. And I think this is a message really important in China. So when China says give the market the decisive role in the allocation of resources, we quite like that message. Allocating resources better is a key factor driving growth. And it's the single biggest factor that could drive growth in the medium term. Make sure that resources flow to the most productive uses. What's the negative thing? The very bottom one. And I promise I'll come to the theme, fragmentation, now as I come to the end. Fragmentation is a drag on growth. We estimate that economic fragmentation could knock off, you know, between 0.2 to 0.8% of GDP. So when we can do better, a key area we can do better is, instead of making trade a drag on growth, again, make trade an engine of growth. So the chart on the left just shows from 2023 compared to 2019, there's been a tripling of trade restrictions. The bar is just member trade restrictions. So again, rather than reviving trade as an engine of growth, we've seen an escalation in trade actions and trade restrictions. The point of the chart on the right is, so far, we don't see that global trade has actually been falling. Either total trade or the red line is goods trade. What we've seen is sort of a flatlining of trade. It's no longer growing. The bottom chart, a bit complicated, but shows that what we have seen is that trade, if we divide the world into different blocks, you could think of a U.S. block and a China block to be overly simple. Trade between blocks has declined much more than trade within blocks. That's a good example of we're seeing fragmentation. All right. This one I've never presented before, so let me give it a try. It's awfully complicated. But this was a scenario we published in our October outlook. And we did this exercise of how would different shocks hurt global growth and hurt inflation. And we stacked these shocks on top of each other. And if you look, the left column is GDP, deviations from our baseline forecast, and the right column is inflation. And then we have a sequence of shocks. The first is tariffs. What's the tariff experiment? This is important because it's probably smaller than what we were talking about in the previous session. The assumption here was 10% tariffs between Europe, US, and China. They each put 10% tariffs on each other. And the US puts 10% tariffs on the rest of the world and the rest of the world on the US. So basically, it's 10% tariffs. You can see that that knocks down growth in the U.S. by 20, and these come into effect in the middle of 2025. Growth in the U.S. by 2026 is 0.6%, sorry, not growth, the level of GDP is 0.6% lower. Impact on inflation is a bit minimal. That's the blue line. I'm focusing on the blue line and the, sorry, way too much going on here. That's this line here. This is the impact on inflation, relatively muted. If we look at the world, global growth slows, and if we look at China, it also slows. That's just tariffs. What we witnessed in 2017-18 is that the trade tensions also created uncertainty that hit investment. So the next layer we add is, what if we add that trade policy uncertainty again has an impact on investment? Again, these are cumulative. So now we're adding the red line, and we can see that growth in the U.S. goes down much more. It more than 1% below the baseline by 2026. For the world, sorry, it's about 0.5% below. The yellow line maybe is not so interesting, renewal of U.S. tax cuts. Green line, I should confess I'm an American. Green line is a little strange for an American, but it says, what if there's a reduction in immigration? It turns out that immigration has been a key factor driving above average growth in the U.S. Makes sense from a growth accounting. More labor, more growth. So the assumption here is, by, I think, 2029, roughly, the U.S. labor force is 1% smaller, and the European labor force is 0.75% smaller as a result of less migration to those countries. And you can see that that knocks down growth further. And the last one is, all these lead to global financial conditions tightening. I think there's a pretty consistent message here, which I think hits the theme of this session, is that, you know, trade fragmentation is costly for the global economy. You know, for a while, the fund has been out there trying to remind people of the costs of fragmentation. So we have a scenario with extreme trade fragmentation could knock 7% off global GDP. We've looked at the impact of technology decoupling, and that could hurt GDP in some countries by up to 5%. We've also looked at the impact of FDI fragmentation, of commodity market fragmentation. Pretty consistent theme here of trying to kind of estimate and document and remind people the economic costs of fragmentation. And a plea to again make trade an engine of growth. And I think there's many reforms we would highlight. The fund has been a big supporter of an open, rules-based multilateral trading system. We have to acknowledge that it would be great to make progress at the WTO in issues like industrial policy and subsidies, to reach new agreements in areas not covered, like e-commerce, services, investment, restore the proper functioning of the dispute resolution system. Kind of the list goes on, so ways to strengthen the multilateral trading system. I want to conclude on a more positive note. And this part commercial for the IMF, but I always like to tell people when the IMF does something, we're not doing it. It's our 191 members agreeing to do something. And since the pandemic hit, the global community has really come together through the IMF and provided a lot of support to low-income and vulnerable countries. We've had a five-fold increase in our lending to low-income countries. We had the largest SDR allocation in our history. I'm not going to attempt to explain what that is because that would take me another hour. Issue with SDR allocation is it goes to countries in proportion to their ownership in the fund. So countries who need it the least, roughly speaking, get the most. So we really encourage the members with stronger positions to rechannel their SDRs to support our lending. And here, since I'm in China, and I'm the China senior res rep, which in English makes me sound just like I'm old. I'm the old res rep. I think it's better. Shoshi Dabia, I think it's better in Chinese. China actually was a real leader in both supporting the SDR allocation and rechanneling their SDR. They moved SDR to support our lending to low-income countries. And my very last point, they also were one of the first and biggest contributors to our fund to finance a new longer-term facility we have to help countries deal with challenges like climate change and future pandemics. And so a thank you to China. And that is definitely the last point. With the fund, there's no issue where the world absolutely has to work together as much as tackling climate change. If we need a plea for international cooperation, we can simply only address climate change if we all work together. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. That was a very insightful presentation. I think you had some mixed messages for us. The global growth is underwhelming. At the same time, we have a divergence between economies. The good news is that inflation is going down, but nevertheless, we are perceiving protectionism in global trade, and I think the interesting fact also was that the message trade fragmentation is costly for the world economy. This is something that we're talking a lot about, but I think it was very interesting that he also showed scenarios how costly it could actually become. So thank you very much, and I would like to give the word to our next speaker, Mr. Han Wang, Chief Economist at Industrial Securities. Please, Mr. Han. The floor is yours.
Good morning, everybody, or good noon, everybody. First of all, I would like to thank FES for inviting me to speak here to share with you my observations. Okay, my topic is mostly about my personal observations and interpretation of policies of the U.S. government. So my topic is on my observations of U.S. Policies and also Fed policies. Well, after U.S. election, obviously, we are going to see some changes to U.S. policies. Well, Biden administration, I can say, call it Biden economics. I think his economic philosophy is very different from his two predecessors. And with the re-election of Trump, we are going to see some changes in his policy framework. So first of all, let's look at the legacy of Biden economics. Based on my observation, there are four pillars to Biden economics. But of course, we need to first of all look at the background. After Biden took office in 2021, he talked about, you know, reuniting the U.S. Actually, Obama and Trump's first term, if you look at their economic policies, there are some common grounds. That is, Fed has had been adopting easy monetary policies during both administrations. Those policies help U.S. recover from financial crisis. However, the side effects is that the poor people have not enjoyed as many benefits as the rich from these policies. So the poor people, they hold less assets. That's why they enjoy less benefits in a low interest rate environment. So low interest rate actually has benefited the rich more. And if you look at Occupy Wall Street campaign, I think it's a reflection of changes in social mindset because of low interest rate policies. So Biden is very different from his two predecessors. First of all, Biden adopted a tough position towards China. So he tried to use industrial subsidies and also small yard high fence policies to fight against China. Small yard high fence plus high tariffs actually have pushed the inflationary level to a very high level. Well, because of high inflation, then they have to adopt a high interest rate policy. That has, to some extent, control the bubbles of assets and also control the inflation. Then with the pandemic, the Biden administration will give a lot of subsidies or even cash to the general public. So these four pillars of Biden economics actually have to some extent achieved Biden's goal of competing against China and constraining and reducing the gap and also the rise of asset value. However, whatever the pillar policy, be it industrial subsidies or high interest rates, U.S. government's fiscal deficit has always been at a very high level. Well, as been mentioned by previous speaker, U.S. has recovered faster than other countries. However, it has adopted a very expansionary fiscal policy. So the essence of expansionary fiscal policy is to borrow from the future generation to subsidize the today's generation. And this is very clear in U.S. economic development model. Now today, when we are looking at the global financial system and the Fed policies, I think there are some issues or conflicts that we need to address. The first is the result of the small yard high fence policy. If you look at the left-hand side, this is the position of a U.S. Investment position is about 350 trillion, but debt is about external debt is about 55 trillion U.S. dollars. So you imagine U.S. is a company. It actually is a company that needs net financing, and of course in the currency of U.S. dollars. But the small yard high fence policy has led to the restriction of a trade flow to a very limited area. We know that currency is a form of a commodity. It's equivalent. If commodities cannot flow freely, can also be limited, can only be limited to a certain area, then how can it become a world currency? So the global U.S. dollar currency flow and these small yard high fence policy, these are contradictory to each other. And so U.S. had to improve the attractiveness of its currency, that is the policy of a high interest rate. So the benefit of this policy is that you can get more returns from your financing investment that can partly or partially offset the negative effect of this small yield hyphens policy. However, high interest rate policy will push the already high level of U.S. debt. That is, U.S. will find it more difficult to service debt. So I think what's more interesting is the bottom right chart. Actually, if you look at the interest expense of a tradable U.S. treasuries, the blue line shows the bond interest rate, and the red shows the bills and short-term debt interest expense. So you can see that the cost of a short-term debt has been increasing over the past couple of years. Well, I think this is easy to understand. For U.S. government, though there is this inversion of interest rates between short-term and long-term bonds, I mean, the government actually is trying to issue more short-term bond to pay back its debt. And so small yield hyphens requires high interest rate, but the high debt level requires low interest rate. So the Fed is actually in a dilemma. So which target or which goal is more important to Fed? I think there this is a deciding factor on whether, you know, Fed is adopting a hawkish or dovish policy. And another factor that we need to consider in the U.S. monetary policy is that the change of a government. Well, except for 2016, almost every change of administration in the White House has led to a significant change in the style of investment markets in the U.S. For example, in the 1990s, we saw a strong performance of IT industry, but then with the more later with the possibility of a Republican taking office, then the we had a dot-com bubble. Then the early 21st century, we saw strong rise of a defense industry, and then in 2008, we saw change of governments. The only exception was in 2016, from 2008 to 2016, when Democrats were in power. You know, the growth stock obviously outperformed the value stocks. And there had been no significant change during Trump's first term. Then in 2020, after Democrats took office again, then we saw again the strong rise of high-tech stocks. So we can see that in the past 16 years, the U.S. stock market has seen a strong performance by the tech sector. Now we are going to see a Republican president coming into office, and this Trump, I think, is a little bit different from what he was 8 years ago, at least in terms of his control of the Republican Party. If so, we are wondering if his administration will lead to another change of the American stock market. I think that we have to be very cautious. So this is my last slide. So today we have to think about this issue. Fed's monetary policy will continue its position in the past, that is focusing on employment and inflation, or will Fed now adopt a very different policy direction facing the challenges. So high interest rate is needed to support U.S. dollar strength because of its high fence policy, but a high interest rate is unfavorable to U.S. bond. And also the Middle East crisis and also fiscal deficit are both unfavorable to U.S. bond. Because so to maintain the strength of U.S. bond, the Fed had to adopt a low interest rate policy. And another complicating factor is the change of government. How will that, you know, impact the capital markets, both bond market and stock market in the U.S.? We are not sure yet. And in the past few years, we have seen an escalating competition or conflict between different parties in the U.S. And And of course, this is a social conflict that has been accumulating over the years because of economic and social changes. Low interest rate benefits the rich, but it will exacerbate the conflicts. Fiscal policy will alleviate the conflicts, but it will bring negative impacts on the U.S. bond. So to understand the future direction of Fed policy, we should not just look at inflation and employment or smoothing the economic cycles. We should also look at the flexibility of its policies. So we have to understand the current circumstances to better predict the future direction of Fed policy. Thank you.
Mr. Wang, for your presentation, you pointed to the small yard high fence policy and its difficulties and limits. Obviously, it's very challenging to imply this kind of policy with high interest rates at the same time. You mentioned the decisive role of the Federal Reserve for the next years to come, and you questioned what the Trump 2.0 administration will mean for the U.S. stock market. So I think a lot of topics which have already been touched lightly, but I think we can now use the time to discuss some of these aspects more in detail. So I would like to open the floor. Who has a question is invited to join the discussion. Paola is the first one, please.
Thank you, Benjamin. I have actually a question for Stephen Barnett. And Stephen, thank you very much. Very interesting presentation. I wonder if you can give us a bit more color or details to international cooperation, how that can happen. And in particular, I have three areas of concern. One is externalities, positive and negative externalities that we have every time we deal with global challenges and domestic policy priorities. And again, about 10, 12 years ago, there was a very promising debate inside the G20 to which the IMF lent some technical assistance, and those report on spillovers impact was very interesting. But this remains a key issue, but I haven't seen much action in practice. The second area is strategic competition. So again, when we talk about trade, it's a big box, but actually the trade when that matters in terms of tariffs is where the next or the current, the ongoing strategic competition is. It's like telecommunication, AI, green industries. So it's not about Christmas trees exporting to the United States. It's about the critical industries that will determine the next, let's call it industrial revolution, the sort of shift in the industrial model or industrial policies in advanced economies, but also the China's industrial revolution, industrial policy, which is also very important. And the third area is actually the reform of the institution, and particularly the WTO, which is the big elephant in the room. Basically, the WTO is a dying institution. It's been in a coma since the de facto end of the Doha round. And again, of course, there's some big walls between the WTO and the IMF. But if Thomas Ferguson's idea, then a trade war will have a big financial impact on financial stability. Perhaps this is something that the IMF should be worried about. And I wonder whether there are any ideas or any directions in terms of reforming and making the WTO an effective institution. Or maybe we forget about it. But anyway.
Stephen, I think this is a lot. These are a lot of questions. You want to answer directly to that?
Sure. And let me take them in reverse order if I got them right. I think in the WTO, I think the funds line has been to strengthen the rules-based trading system with the WTO at its core. I don't think, in terms of what we've been doing, and certainly what I have been doing, it has more to remind the world of the benefits of trade and the cost of fragmentation. When it gets to reform of WTO, it's certainly not for me as the Beijing res rep to tell the WTO how to reform, and I don't know if it's even for the IMF to tell a sister institution. But I think the deeper point is we need a well-functioning global trade system. And to avoid the costs of fragmentation, where I think the fund has, if I say so myself, been pretty good, is consistently reminding the politicians of the economic cost of fragmentations. I don't think we're naive. Trade wars, and it happens for many reasons. Economics isn't always the only factor. But politicians should at least be aware of the economic consequences. And I think we've been trying to say that pretty loudly. On the strategic, competition. So, I've been at the fund 27 years. And interestingly, recently we've seen, and this will cover both strategic competition and spillovers, all of a sudden a renewed interest in industrial policies. And, to be blunt, a lot of us old-time macro people, we never really liked industrial policies. We don't think it works, but I'm not supposed to say that. So we have a much more nuanced official line on industrial policies that they should be well-targeted, where there is a clear externality or a market failure. But the risk with industrial policy is twofold. And the one that gets a lot of attention is the spillovers. And we like to quantify stuff at the fund. We looked at when there's a subsidy action, I think there was 4,000 kind of industrial policy or subsidy actions in the U.S., Euro area, and China between start of 2023 and June 2024. 4,000. 60% were in advanced economies, actually. There was a 70, if I want to be precise, it was 73.8% chance. So let's say 75% chance of a retaliatory action by one country within 1 year. So if the U.S., China, or EU put in place a subsidy, 75% of the time there was a response by someone else within 1 year. This is a sort of kind of the tit-for-tat escalation from industrial policies. We've done research showing how industrial policy, including in China, published in an annual report, affects imports and exports and effectively affects trading partners, so trying to quantify that. But I think the second thing about industrial policy that a lot of us old-time macro people, is a real risk of a misallocation of resources. This has nothing to do with the spillovers to trading partners. It's not good for your own economy. It puts too many resources in the wrong places, to be overly simple. I think that's a bit on strategic competition and spillovers. How to strengthen international cooperation. And I think at the fund, maybe I'm biased, despite a rise in geopolitical fragmentation, we were still able to get pretty significant changes to our lending toolkit during the pandemic. We were able to provide debt relief to all of the countries that needed it. Maybe the process was too slow, but it happened. And I don't know if you asked in 2020 at the beginning of the pandemic whether we would be able to do that. I wouldn't have been confident. So I think there is scope for cooperation. Maybe some of these issues are super technical and they don't get politicized, so you can kind of roll up your sleeves and work with all of the relevant players. But I'd like to say I grew up in California. I tend to be an optimist. I think that there's always scope for cooperation. Obviously easier when issues are less politicized than when they are. I don't know if I gave you a satisfactory answer to any of those questions, but.
Thank you so much. The Californian optimism, I think, is what was missing in the election, no? The next question comes from Mr. Zhao.
Yeah, thank you.
Hello, I have a question for Wang Han and Stephen, the same question. Now, the Chinese domestic economy is being challenged, and we are perhaps having the most difficult time in the decades since reform and opening up kicked off. Now, many people are very concerned whether we are going to have even worse problems or will the situation improve. So, what is your opinion for both of you? Let me try first. I should like to say the Chinese economy is facing those problems that were seen over the past 300 years when the developed countries were trying to industrialize. China is now in many industrial sectors number one in terms of the capacity. Now, when the country, any country approaches the completion of industrialization, you will have to see how your industrial capacity is to be harmoniously connected with the global capacity and global demand. Now, the Chinese capacity takes up about one-third of the world total, even though its population is perhaps only one-fifth. Now, we used to have industrialization, urbanization, and globalization as the drivers. Now, in this process, now many people, they bought consumer products, built houses, and also built the capital, bought the capital goods. So therefore, we produced a lot and consumed a lot, but now we are coming to the approaching stage or the beginning of the end. We are at the beginning of the end. Therefore, how can our industrial capacities really coordinate with the international demand or international capacity? Now, I know that other strategists in other countries also met with such problems, and they made their proposals. For the Chinese, we have, for example, also been making attempts with, let's say, the Belt and Road Initiative. So down the road, I believe that we'll have to, while drawing upon the international market, also try to develop our domestic demands. And of course, we are also try to help the developing countries have better infrastructures. So these are areas where we could coordinate. And if we can do this well, of course, we can continue to grow. Otherwise, there will be, of course, difficulties on the further growth. Thank you.
China economy. I think it's actually quite similar. So we forecast we're 4.8% growth this year, 4.5% next year. We're 3.3% in the medium term, which for us is 2029. And although we don't publish longer forecasts, we have a working paper, which is, you can call it quasi-official, because it's the same paper that does our medium-term forecast, 2.5% 10 years down the road. Chinese government thinks we're too negative. They think medium-term growth is 5 to 6%. So if I were to, I never would be so happy to be wrong. Let's hope they're right. You know, I think our global theme, we can do better, applies to China, and maybe just to pick up on two areas where we think China can do better in the medium term. One is on productivity growth. You know, China, like the rest of the world, has seen a decline in productivity. And I think what's key is two, one, better allocation of resources. To give the Chinese government some credit, they explicitly mention in the government work report the importance of boosting total factor productivity. As a macroeconomist, and we love seeing stuff like that. It's not so often you get TFP in a high-level government work report. The recipe also is not bad. Give the market the decisive role in allocation of resources. Level the playing field between domestic, foreign, and private firm, you know, SOEs and private firms. World-class business environment, law-based, market-oriented. I think the challenge is to do that. The second thing is to develop the service sector. Maybe in simple terms, do in services what they did in manufacturing. So that's on productivity. I think the second, maybe the one area that the whole world agrees is China needs to find ways to boost consumption. So go to a sustained period where consumption grows faster than GDP. And I'll stop there because I do give whole talks. It's my favorite topic, and I think it's complicated. But in the end, it would be great for China. Faster consumption growth means living standards grow faster than GDP. And it's good for the world because I think it was Keynes who said that the purpose for production is the end to satisfy a consumer. Consumption is the ultimate goal of activity. So higher consumption in China is good for China and good for the world.
Thank you so much. I think this is also a topic that we will continue discussing maybe all the whole day. What about the Chinese economy? Thomas, please.
We have to share this. I'm a little underwhelmed, actually, by some of the comments here. Let me just say straightforwardly, on the question of international cooperation, it seems to me we have a very large problem in raw materials right now. And that is to say, in the emerging information age world, it needs a different kind of raw materials, and some of you folks know very well what they are, cobalt and such things. And frankly, the U.S. and China are very clearly at loggerheads on this. And I myself think that if you're going to talk about international cooperation, we need to address this. I'm myself not thrilled by private market solutions here. I think something along the order of the old Keynes plans, which would have actually built some kind of joint buffer stocks, some kind of scheme to have people not contending militarily, because all of the commercial stuff on this that I have seen on both U.S. and China comes with military sides to it. In the Argentine deals with the Chinese present with the old regime there, came along deals for trucks and things like that. And the U.S. has way too many troops in too many countries in Latin America right now. I'm not happy with that stuff. I have not been a fan of U.S. troop expansion. But this is kind of a serious and growing problem. And discussions of international cooperation need to get off the point which we all agree would be desirable in principle and get down to specifics. I'm hoping that we can, between the U.S. and China, we could work some things out. This doesn't mean that everybody in the Trump administration or want to do it, but people need to start changing their thinking on this. My second point is I'm not so happy with the sort of net summaries of international financial positions. Just take a look, for example. People are pouring money into the U.S. from all over the world. They want not just the fact that rates are higher or something like that, but they all think they're getting in on biotechnology or AI, artificial intelligence, and a string of other things. Now, how is it? And I would say I know they're inflated. I could, I more or less told you it was a railway boom, and that. But there's a lot of real wealth also being produced there. And that's not reflected in the standard thing. I think Robert Eisner made this critique 30 years ago, and I'm unclear about how consistently that's carried out. But you can see there's the funniest joke I heard. It's not that funny. It depends on where you're coming from. If the U.S. tariff scheme goes into effect, who's the biggest loser in Europe? Ireland. Why? Because they're not going to be exporting that much into the United States. But all of their schemes, the U.S. company, something like 30% of the Irish budget is financed by U.S. firms that just move their IT and other profits over there, like Apple, that shows up as a gain for Ireland. That's not where they actually do the earning. People are going to have to rethink this business, and that the fact that if you're telling me that among the most productive economies in the world is necessarily stuck with high interest rates, I rather doubt it. I think that has to do with short-run issues in government finance. That's clearly an issue more than anything else about the tax split between the fact that bluntly, the American rich don't want to pay taxes. This is obvious. And you can cure the problem that way. This doesn't have much to do with productive anything, but it has a lot to do with, if you like, distributional policy inside the U.S. And discussions of this topic need to reflect that. You can't just sit there and sort of report what I'd say are pretty bad neoclassical economic thinking and measurements built on what's just, it's not reflective of what's actually the world's going.
Thank you, Thomas. We have another participant wanting to contribute, and then I would give the word back to our panelists that we close our session. Please.
Thank you. Stephen and Wang Zouxi, I would like to ask one question. So China's CPI has been close to zero for many months, and GDP deflator has been negative for six quarters in a row. So the first question is, do you, not the IMF, because I know you have the official line, do you think China already falling into this deflationary trap? So that's the first question. So if you agree China already falling into the deflation trap, how much stimulus do you think China government needs to do to get the economy out of this trap? And, there's a debate among the Chinese economists. Some people say, oh, we should use a physical stimulus, not, monetary policy. Some people say, oh, the cutting policy rate is useless. So do you agree with this, or you think should you use both? Thanks.
Hey. I don't think you'd hear an IMF guy say that interest rate cuts are useless. So I think the answer would clearly be both. In terms of policy stimulus, we see room for more fiscal and we see room for more monetary support. We for a long time advocated more reliance on interest rates for monetary policy. I think on fiscal, as soon as you start talking fiscal numbers in China, people's head starts to swim because there's like a lot of different numbers flying around. Let me try in real, if possible, in kind of simple terms. In the medium term, we know China needs fiscal adjustment. But I like to joke, you can always start your diet tomorrow. In a country like China, where there is not going to be financing constraints, they can clearly start their diet tomorrow. So we advocate medium-term fiscal adjustment, but I think in the near term, there's room for more support. We usually couch that in two ways. One, we tend not to count support that's done to, let's say, clean up the real estate mess. Money well spent. So any outlays, and we estimate up to 5% of GDP to accelerate the welcome and necessary correction in real estate, but to put it in the rearview mirror would be welcome. And then, of course, over the medium term, we need fiscal adjustment in China. But in the near term, there's room for more support. The second is to reorient fiscal policy in two ways. One is less off-budget local government financing vehicle support and more on-budget. And the second is more related, actually, more support for household consumption and less infrastructure spending. I think, kind of contrary to conventional wisdom in most countries, we think that that change in mix would actually boost demand in China. Lastly, on the deflation risk, the GDP deflator has been negative, seven of the past eight quarters. You only said the last six, but if you go back eight, seven of the last eight, clearly price pressures are weak. Economies need nominal GDP growth. Sometimes maybe we're too caught up on the value of zero for inflation. Even low inflation and low nominal GDP growth create a more challenging environment to deleverage and grow out of your debt, basically. So clearly, they should keep an eye on the kind of low inflation and take steps to get inflation back up to target. The steps I just said should help by restoring demand, should help get inflation back up. Our official forecast makes me very popular in China. I didn't show the slide, but we have inflation basically returning to normal by the end of next year.
That's our official forecast. So end of period CPI is at 2% by the end of next year, and GDP deflator is pretty close to back to normal by the end of next year. Let's hope we're right.
Thank you so much. I was already advised that we are heading for the lunch because we are entering lunchtime. I think there's a lot to continue talking about after the lunch and during the lunch. So I want to thank Stephen Barnett and Han Wang. Thank you so much for your inputs. And I think we had a very interesting discussion. And we will now have lunch like close to here at room 9 and 10, I think. And looking forward to continue the discussion at 1:45.
吃饭。